From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Yosemite, the Great Smoky Mountains, Grand Teton, these are some of the national parks you've most likely heard of. Well, today, as part of our series on the national parks, we're going to visit some lesser-known locations, parks we've picked out for their size, the largest and the smallest. First, NPR's Robert Smith takes us to the smallest.
This is going to be a very short tour. America's tiniest national park is up here on the second floor of an old house in the Society Hill neighborhood of Philadelphia, and I'll show you how small it is. I can walk across it in 1, 2, 3, 4 steps. I'll ask the ranger here, what's the exact size?
0.02 acres.
The name may actually be longer than the actual park. It's the Thaddeus
Kosciuszko National Memorial.
Thaddeus Kosciuszko National Memorial.
Yes.
I guess I shouldn't worry too much about it. Ranger Andrew McDougall tells me that everybody mangles this park's name. The important thing is that you come away with a sense that it's named after a bona fide hero. Kosciuszko came over from his native Poland. He was a military engineer, and he fought in the American Revolutionary War. And to list all of his accomplishments would take, 6 minutes, which is the length of the movie they play here.
Who is this Polish general that Americans cheer? He was a son of landowning gentry
and a friend of peasants.
Or it could take 12 minutes if you watch the movie again in Polish.
Gorący sierpniowy dzień 1797 roku.
Kosciuszko is like the George Washington of Poland, and Polish Americans have plastered his name on everything. It's on bridges, monuments, mountains. There are cities in Texas and Mississippi named after the guy. This place, this tiny room, was the place Kosciuszko rented for 7 months while he was appealing to Congress for his back pay. I mean, it's no Mount Vernon, but in the 1970s, a Polish-American businessman bought the place and donated it to the National Park Service.
So we kind of just set the room up to look the way it would have looked on any given day that Kosciuszko would have been here. So, it's a little sloppy in the room. There's some papers scattered around.
Now, let's be honest, this is no Liberty Bell. There are not lines around the corner. How long can you go here without anyone stopping by?
Well, that varies depending upon the time of the year.
Gone days, weeks?
No, there's at least one visitor per day.
Okay, if we get bored, we can always play with the interactive displays here.
This is such a small room. Such a small room for such a great man. But it was typical of Thaddeus Kosciuszko.
So we've been open for a while and nobody's coming through the door.
We've had no visitors yet, but that's not uncommon.
It's a waiting game.
It can be.
All right, clearly if I'm going to interview a visitor to this place, I'm going to have to pull one in myself. Excuse me, you guys interested in going into the Thaddeus Kosciuszko National Memorial?
I think maybe a Polish revolutionary hero is probably more at the bottom of my list.
Fair enough, but Thomas Campbell does say that the next time he comes by, he will try and stop in. Back inside, Ranger Andrew McDougall is still waiting patiently. It's actually one of the easier gigs in the Park Service.
We have no shuttle bus, we have no food service, we don't have any camping facilities. Maybe we could look at it as more quality visitation than quantity. The people who are going to make the point to come to this site are people who are going to be very interested.
And sure enough, in the mid-afternoon, the door opens and in walks Jolanta Kardasz. She's Polish-American, and she is not going to miss this tiny little corner of the national park system.
He came to America and fought for liberty because that's what he stood for. He believed in it. In Poland, everybody knows him.
She watches the movie, she peers into the exhibit, and then she tells me I've been pronouncing the man's name wrong.
Tadeusz Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko.
Such a sweet name for a military man.
Ranger McDougall tells her that she might want to come back again. The whole place, all 0.02 acres of it, is going to be rehabbed with all new exhibits and cool new artifacts like the man's sword and a lock of his hair.
The exhibits will really showcase Thaddeus Kosciuszko as an international freedom fighter, or as Thomas Jefferson termed him, the purest son of liberty he had ever known.
It's a lot of praise to fit into a very small park. Robert Smith, NPR News, at the Thaddeus
Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko.
Kosciuszko National Memorial in Philadelphia.
One of the best-known photographs of the Vietnam War shows a group of children running down a road after napalm was dropped on their village. Among the children is a naked girl, her arms spread apart, badly burned, her face full of terror. The photo was taken 36 years ago this month, and our This I Believe essay today comes from the main subject of that photo, Kim Fook, that girl, now grown. Here's our series curator, independent producer, Jay Allison.
Kim Fook is known as the girl in the picture. She's 45 years old now and living in Toronto, Canada, with her husband and two children. Kim Fook came to her belief literally by accident, and although it took a long time for her to find it, she has been sustained by it ever since. Here's Kim Fook with her essay for This I Believe.
On June 8, 1972, I ran out from Cao Dai Temple in my village, Trang Bang, South Vietnam. I saw an airplane getting lower and then four bombs falling down. I saw fire everywhere around me. Then I saw the fire over my body, especially on my left arm. My clothes had been burned off by fire. I was 9 years old, but I still remember my thoughts at that moment. I would be ugly, and people would treat me in a different way. My picture was taken in that moment on road number 1 from Saigon to Phnom Penh. After a soldier gave me some drink and poured water over my body, I lost my consciousness. Several days after, I realized that I was in a hospital where I spent 14 months and had 17 operations. It was a very difficult time for me when I went home from the hospital. Our house was destroyed. We lost everything, and we just survived day by day. Although I suffer from pain, itching, and headaches all the time, the long hospital stay made me dream to become a doctor. But my studies were cut short by the local government. They wanted me as a symbol of the state. I could not go to school anymore. The anger inside me was like a hatred as high as a mountain. I hated my life. I hated all people who were normal because I was not normal. I really wanted to die many times. I spent my daytime in the library to read a lot of religious books to find a purpose for my life. One of the books that I read was the Holy Bible. In Christmas 1982, I accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior. It was an amazing turning point in my life. God helped me to learn to forgive, the most difficult of all lessons. It didn't happen in a day, and it wasn't easy, but I finally got it. Forgiveness made me free from hatred. I still have many scars on my body and severe pain most days, but my heart is cleansed. Napalm is very powerful, but faith, forgiveness, and love are much more powerful. We would not have war at all if everyone could learn how to live with true love, hope, and forgiveness. If that little girl in the picture can do it, ask yourself, can you?
Kim Fook, with her essay for This I Believe, which came to us through our collaboration with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. To see photographs, the famous one from Vietnam in 1972, along with a recent picture, visit our website at npr.org, where you'll also find all the essays in our series and our invitation to submit your own. For This I Believe, I'm Jay Allison.
Support for This I Believe comes from Prudential Retirement.
We start a road trip this morning that'll take us to some of the most spectacular places on Earth. We're talking about America's national parks. There are nearly 400 of them, covering mountains and deserts, glaciers, swamps, and city blocks. All this week, NPR will be visiting some of those parks, and our first stop, the Grand Canyon in Arizona. As NPR's Ted Robbins reports, some of the people who work there are as memorable as the scenery.
In peak season, summertime, it takes about 6,000 people just to keep Grand Canyon National Park running. None of them looks or sounds like he belongs here more than Casey Murph. Picture a skinny Yosemite Sam, right down to the thick red mustache. He manages the park's South Rim mule operation. At 7:30 every morning, Murph and his cowboys take about 4 dozen mules to a corral next to the Bright Angel trailhead. There, the mules wait while he spends 45 minutes warning visitors who are about to ride.
I don't recommend this to you if you're scared to death of heights. Fact is, if you're scared to death of heights, you will freak out. And when you freak out, your mule thinks you have a good reason for freaking out, and then your mule freaks out too.
Now keep in mind, the riders have come from all over the world. Some booked their trip a year in advance. And a few, like Ken Burkhardt, even went on a diet to meet the 200-pound weight limit.
So I dropped about 25, 26 pounds because we knew we were going to come on this trip. So it's a good motivator.
Unlike Casey Murph's lecture, which is designed to unmotivate the weak-willed.
Folks, I don't know what you might be expecting from this. I hope that you are not imagining a pony ride at Disneyland. This is not the easy way to see the canyon, folks. There is no easy way to see the canyon.
It's a narrow, winding trail down. And mules, he says, don't like surprises.
When your mule sees that rock that wasn't there yesterday, he is certain that rock was put there by the Grand Canyon mule-eating troll and will not pass it. Unless you stay so close to the mule in front of you, when he looks ahead, all he can see is another mule's rear end.
Are you nervous?
Yep. Definitely.
Oh.
I'm more scared.
I am.
But that won't stop Jenna Michael or anyone else from going today.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime event. Do it and get a chance to do something like this is pretty awesome.
Fact is, there's never been a fatality on these rides. The mules don't want to fall any more than the riders. With an expert eye, Murph matches them up.
I'll look at people's eyes, and if they're scared, then I'm going to try to give them a mule that's going to take care of them. But if they look like they're confident, well, then I'll take that into consideration, too. Ornery little boys, they're going to get these ornery mules, you know.
Around 9 a.m., the riders finally head down the trail. By 10 a.m., the day crowd is arriving at the park entrance station. 6 lanes of cars and buses. Ranger Sandra Breach stands in a kiosk taking money from drivers.
It's $25, and good day to you. And the first viewpoint's 5 miles straight ahead. Thank you.
That viewpoint would be Mather Point, almost always crowded. The view, of course, is spectacular here, even though you can barely see the Colorado River at the bottom. The canyon is up to 18 miles wide and more than a vertical mile deep. It's hot at the bottom, cooler on the rim, where it's not desert, but a tall evergreen forest. Few visitors realize that among those evergreens is a small city with city rules.
That was a stop sign that you did not stop at, and that was a school zone that you were speeding through.
Ranger Angela Boyers writes the driver a traffic ticket. Yes, there's a school here, and churches, a cemetery, even an impound lot holding cars that have seen the usual and not so usual mishaps.
Obviously, the green one was an accident. I believe that was an elk. And a rollover after hitting the elk. This was a stolen vehicle out of Mississippi. The one with the bike rack on the back was actually the girls' basketball coach, and he got busted with methamphetamines.
How often do people fall in?
The accidental trip and falls into the canyon are very rare.
That's Lori Tuttle. She supervises the Grand Canyon Emergency Dispatch Center. She pulls out a book, Grand Canyon Fatality Log. Most of the entries are heart attacks, but up to a half dozen people every year commit suicide at the Grand Canyon, usually by jumping in.
The most interesting fatality that sticks out in my mind, if I can find it here, is the gentleman who jumped out of the helicopter.
This was a scenic helicopter ride?
Yes.
By far, though, the most common medical problems are on the trail in summer. A string of heat-related deaths 10 years ago prompted the Park Service to start a program where rangers like Ian Buchanan hike the Bright Angel Trail below the rim, carrying a medical kit and 5 liters of water. Preventative search and rescue.
So if that's all the water you got, you can probably use some more. You want some? I got some.
Sure.
Yeah.
We get a lot of people who are unprepared for the elements, who don't go in with enough water, enough food, or enough pre-planning to know how long their trip is and how hot it's going to be.
Is it harder than you thought it'd be, or think you prepared well enough?
Well, I didn't do anything. I sit in a chair all day at work, and I smoke 2 packs a day, so for the circumstances, I'm doing pretty damn good.
The Park Service estimates only 1% of its visitors ever make it to the bottom. Only 10% even go below the rim. By early evening, the red rocks are turning orange in the setting sun. Families are at dinner, and couples sit on benches looking out at the view.
So as you're coming through here, cool air is pulling in.
At 10 p.m., Ranger David Smith is leading a moonlight nature walk at Mather Point for 300 people. He has to use a portable microphone.
We're going to go about 4 or 5 minutes to the next stop. Everyone doing all right? Okay, excellent. That's what I want to hear. Let's have some fun.
By close to midnight, the crowd has thinned. Those left, Smith says, start to reflect.
You know, they've never really thought about why we have parks. They know that it costs the government a lot of money to maintain these things. So why do they have them? They come here and they go, wow, that's why they have them. So I can actually think about things and I can think about my place in this world and what am I doing in this world.
Some visitors stay here only a few hours, others a few days. Some of the people who work here stay a summer, others for decades. They are the ones with the time to not just see Grand Canyon National Park, but to experience it. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
And if you want to see the smallest national park or the largest, you can take an audio slideshow tour at npr.org. Tomorrow, national park officials battle thieves who try to steal artifacts. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This is a story of a social reformer, a famous campaigner against slum housing, and a device that made his campaigning effective. Imagine it's 1888, New York City. The Lower East Side is the most densely populated place on Earth. Block after block of tenements house the working poor immigrants of the city. Italians, Irish, Germans, Jews, Czechs, Chinese. Imagine the darkness of an unlit corridor in one of those tenements, a corridor that opens onto windowless rooms 10 feet square, where entire families live, and might even work, too, sewing or rolling cigars. Out of the darkness, a door opens. A man with a Danish accent leads a team of amateur photographers who are accompanied by a policeman. They position their camera on a tripod and ignite a mixture of magnesium and potassium chlorate powder. A flash illuminates their squalor. It would take the photographers a few minutes to reload that early ancestor of the flashbulb, and then on to another tenement scene. And despite the blackness of a room or an unlit street, a picture is taken, a document of urban poverty. In the late 1880s, a New York City police reporter named Jacob Riis, that's spelled R-I-I-S, took pictures that way in Lower Manhattan.
We're on the corner of Baxter and Baird Street.
There are a couple of new books about Jacob Riis, and Bonnie Yokelson co-authored one of them.
One of Riis's most famous pictures was taken on Baird Street. It's called 5 cents a spot. At the time, it was legal to charge 7 cents for someone to sleep for the night. And this place, this 5 cents a spot place, was illegal. There were over 20 people in the room, including a mother and a baby.
Yeah, a spot didn't mean a room. A spot meant
a
piece
place
of floor,
on the
perhaps.
Floor. Exactly.
In a room with
exactly.
strangers.
And when you look at this picture, you see the shock on the faces of the many people who are on the floor and sort of bunk beds in the back.
They must have been shocked. Magnesium flash powder was something new. It was developed in Germany in 1887. Riis's burst of light must have been a stunning surprise, but it made the dim, airless lives of the poor visible to the middle class. In public slideshows and in his book, How the Other Half Lives, Riis, who was born in Ribe, Denmark, used those images and his descriptions to jar the conscience of prosperous native-born Americans.
Well, we're crossing Canal Street and headed down to
what was in Reese's day the notorious Mulberry Bend.
A few days ago, we took a walk with Bonnie Yokelson and her co-author Daniel Sitram through Mulberry Street. It's recently gentrified, but this was where Reese campaigned against the housing conditions of the day. Sitram is a historian.
You can still see the really small size of the building lots. The typical building lot in New York for a tenement was 25 feet wide and 100 feet deep going back. And if you look at some of these buildings, you can see that the front is only about 25 feet, four or five stories. And that's one of the things that Reese railed against, the small size of the building lots and the fact that people used up the whole lot, which led to the fact that a lot of these tenements, the so-called rear tenements, built behind other tenements, would have no access to light or air.
In all of the rooms were interior rooms in those,
right.
in those
Correct.
Units. And,
interestingly enough, up through the 1890s, there were a series of court decisions. One of my favorite ones was essentially saying that there is no right to light or air for a renter or an owner. And so the idea that you have somehow a right to a window or the right to some breathing space was not a legal right that anyone recognized until much later.
That's Daniel Sitram. His co-author, Bonnie Yokelson, is a curator at the Museum of the City of New York. She writes about Jacob Riis's photography. Reese thought of himself as a writer, and he was evidently a gripping storyteller in the lectures that he gave to accompany his lantern slideshows. Yokelson says that he was a passionate reformer, but he was also very conservative. He believed that Protestant philanthropy and the self-restraint of ethical landlords was the best remedy, not the government. And he was very much a product of his time.
Reese organized his most famous book, which was a bestseller and launched his career as a reformer, How the Other Half Lives, as a kind of slum tour, going neighborhood by neighborhood and describing ethnic group by ethnic group. That was a pre-established literary genre, which he was borrowing. It had a lot of entertainment value. It was come see the colorful Italians and the mystifying Chinese, and there was this sense of he was playing on a certain, the entertainment value of these stereotypes. So on the one hand, there was a sort of racial typology that he believed in, but it was also popular culture. And he abandoned that after How the Other Half Lives.
One of the things that makes Reese so fascinating are these contradictions in his work. I see Reese more as a transitional figure. He's somebody that did bring with him those stereotypes and those that sort of racialized thinking of the day, but he's also somebody that began insisting on the importance of environment. Or as he put it at one point, it's the squalid houses that make for squalid people.
Rediscovering Jacob Riis, the book that Bonnie Yokelson and Daniel Sitram collaborated on, is one of two new books about Riis. The Other Half is the title of a new biography by Tom Buk-Swienty. He's a Danish historian who only heard of Riis when he was a Danish newspaper correspondent in the U.S. Riis was once one of the most famous men in this country, a close friend and confidant of President Theodore Roosevelt, the epitome of the immigrant made good, good in his case being measured by political and social influence, not by wealth. But Tom Buk-Swienty says all that success didn't impress the Danes back in Riis's hometown of Ribe.
That is very difficult for Americans to understand. The mindset is so different in Denmark, or at least was very different. I mean, although this was not a rich town, it was sort of a place where there was a lot of scarcity. And you sort of had the opposite philosophy as you do in America. If someone does well, people are sort of mistrusting of that person because they believe maybe he's taking something away from me. If my neighbor does well, maybe he's sort of taking something away from me. And it's sort of a place where you cherish the egalitarian values. So if someone sticks out, people are mistrusting that person. So when he came back later as a famous person, he was almost cold-shouldered. And it's very, very strange. And Riis couldn't really understand that himself because he had become an American in that process. He was very proud of his achievements. But people, they were just very skeptical.
I mean, the attitude being sort of, who do you think you are, Mr. Big Shot?
Exactly.
Buk-Swienty tells the story of how young Jacob Riis, the underachieving son of a schoolmaster, set off for America when the girl he adored turned down his proposal of marriage. He worked in the U.S. as a carpenter, and in the financial panic of 1873, he experienced unemployment firsthand.
He himself experienced extreme poverty. There was a time where he just didn't have a place to sleep. He had no money. He was totally penniless. When he came, worked as a journalist later, and he worked in the tenement districts also as a police reporter, he knew by experience that this mass of poor people were not sort of faceless people, but they were, like himself, people that came to America in order to try to make a better living. So he felt empathy with these people and could write about them because he knew what they were going through.
And he, when he experienced poverty, he experienced it not as someone who had fled famine or extreme poverty in the old country, but who had actually been the school teacher's son and had known exactly. some comfort back in a very old world part of the old country.
Yeah, that's a very precise way to put it. He didn't know better. He thought that the rest of the world was like Denmark.
Poverty struck Jacob Riis as something abnormal, even for the various immigrant groups whom he regarded as exotic. When he lived in New York City, about 40% of the population was foreign-born. It's just about the same share today. Millions of immigrants were in the process of becoming American. Tom Buxvienti studied Riis's diaries and says he's found the moment when the Danish carpenter, he wasn't yet a reporter, became an American, mentally. He says it happened when Riis learned that the girl back home, the one he'd been pining for, had gotten engaged to a Danish military hero.
Now, when he learned about that, and at that time he had been in the U.S. for a couple of years, he was shocked. I mean, that came for him as a total surprise, and his world, you could say, went dark for a few days. He's sort of resting in an inn, and he's writing about that, and he says, there's nothing more left for me, and he writes all this in Danish. But what happens a few days later, which I find very significant, is that all of a sudden, he begins to write in English.
It's a remarkable turning point when you decide to change the language in which you write the diary, which at least that point, Riis would have no reason to think would be a document that people would pore over in libraries. It was a very private document.
It is. It's very remarkable. It's almost eerie when you sit with that diary and you have it in your hands and you just can see that something is changing in this man.
Tom Buxvienti's The Other Half is being published in this country in August. The book uses a famous Jacob Riis photo on the cover. It's a street scene, and Bonnie Yokelson took us to the place where Riis shot it. It's now in the middle of Columbus Park.
Where we're standing in this park is the site of Riis's most famous photograph, which is Bandit's Roost. He actually put the address of Bandit's Roost on the negative sleeve of that image, which was 59 and a half Mulberry.
I want you to describe the picture.
The picture shows an alley with laundry hanging in the background. On the left side is a mother with two children and some ash cans, some garbage cans out in the alley. And on the right side are a group of bandits, sort of scary-looking guys, hovering and hulking and looking at the camera in a threatening way. So it's both, it has a kind of romanticism to it, and an exotic air and a sort of sinister air. It's actually very cinematic.
Think Martin Scorsese's Gangs of New York. That's what it looks like. And Jacob Riis, who died in 1914, might not have resisted that comparison. He was a social reformer who was also, with his slideshows and his lectures, a natural showman. Historian Daniel Citrom.
I do think Riis is the first muckraker. I think he represents sort of the beginning of a certain progressive sensibility. And by that I mean this. Riis believed that it was important, that it was crucial to try to rouse the conscience of the public, to appeal to the conscience. This belief that if we could simply expose conditions, if people simply knew how bad things were, they would rise up and change them. And that becomes a real hallmark, it seems to me, of the progressive era, progressive reform. And the photograph really was the way that, you know, he tried to do that, along with the journalism.
And along with that chemical reaction that made the obscure lives of the poor brightly visible to the rest of the country. Daniel Citrom and Bonnie Yokelson's book is called Rediscovering Jacob Riis. That sound of the 19th century flash, by the way, is from a 21st century hobbyist, and we'll hear from him in a moment. And Jacob Riis's beloved Elizabeth, the woman in Denmark who turned him down in favor of the military hero, well, as the story goes, the hero died. Riis wrote to her. She answered. He went back to Denmark and married her. Biographer Tim Buxvienti says there was never any doubt in Riis's mind
that they would live in America, which they did. You can read about that and see some of Reese's pictures at npr.org.
The Office of Special Counsel is a watchdog agency. Its role is to investigate complaints from government workers who say they've been mistreated. For years, whistleblower groups have complained that the watchdog is asleep. They say Scott Block, who runs the Office of Special Counsel, has ignored stacks of legitimate complaints from federal employees. Now the Justice Department is investigating Block. FBI agents stormed his home and office in a high-profile raid. And this morning we're going to take a step back and look in detail at one of the complaints Block ignored. It's the case of a woman named Benetta Mansfield.
This case had everything. You know, it had whistleblowing, it had prohibited personnel practices, it had a whole laundry list of things going on.
Mansfield used to be chief of staff at a federal agency that handles labor disputes with airlines and railroads. It's called the National Mediation Board. In 2002, President Bush appointed his first new board member, a Texas lawyer named Ed Fitzmaurice.
As soon as he got on board, he started using abusive language towards me, that I was Bush League, that I was a pushy Jewish woman and he didn't need another one in his life.
Fitzmaurice refused repeated offers to tell his side of the story, but other people corroborate Mansfield's account, like Fitzmaurice's former secretary.
You solemnly swear or affirm the information you're about to give here today is the whole truth and nothing but the truth, ma'am?
I do.
Okay, please be seated.
Barbara Casey sat down for this interview with attorneys at the Office of Special Counsel in 2004. The following year, she died of cancer.
Did you ever have occasion to, in Mr. Fitzmaurice's presence here, to make any other derogatory types of comments towards Miss Mansfield?
Well, he referred to her as a B-I-T-C-H. Frequently.
It turns out Fitzmaurice had a history with Benetta Mansfield, although she didn't know it. Years ago, Mansfield disqualified one of Fitzmaurice's friends from a union election. Fitzmaurice told his secretary, Barbara Casey, that Benetta Mansfield would have to go.
I said, you know, what do you mean she's going to have to go? Well, she deep-sixed a good buddy of mine in Texas.
Fitzmaurice never forgot what Mansfield had done.
I've since come to know him as someone who's perfectly happy to lay in the weeds and wait for his chance again.
This is Frank Dugan, the man who brought Fitzmaurice to the National Mediation Board.
In the first week that he came to work, he had three women crying, physically crying in the office. He's a bully, and he's particularly a bully with women.
Dugan says he's speaking out now to, in his words, atone for his sins.
I really believe in public service, and this guy does not belong in public service. And I invented him. I mean, here I coached him. I taught him how to get the job. I taught him about the National Mediation Board. I taught him about labor law. I've never been so wrong in my life.
Fitzmaurice eventually followed through on his promise to get rid of Mansfield. With the help of others at the National Mediation Board, he downgraded her performance evaluation and demoted her. How are you handling all of this?
Not well. I was very emotional. I was calling my lawyer every day and bursting into tears. I was a mess.
So Mansfield took her case to the government office that's supposed to handle these types of problems. Which brings us back to the Office of Special Counsel and Scott Block. The office decided to investigate further. That's rare.
We were feeling like this case was, you know, we were making some progress. I was feeling really good.
Sources with firsthand knowledge of the investigation say OSC was prepared to act. Lawyers there drafted a document that would have stopped Benetta Mansfield's demotion. Would have, but didn't. The career attorneys handling Mansfield's case were forced out, for reasons having nothing to do with the case. And for Mansfield, that was a catastrophe. Here's her lawyer, Beth Slavitt.
You finally get over that hurdle, and a meteor hits your case, and all of a sudden, it's destroyed.
The case went to a political deputy at the Office of Special Counsel, who threw it out. Jim Mitchell is the office spokesman, and he says the case predates him, so he can't comment on it specifically. But he also says the office can't pursue every case and still remain efficient.
We have, in the last few years, made quite a bit of progress in getting rid of backlogs of whistleblower cases and prosecuting cases and getting settlements for people, getting corrective action.
There's a common theme here.
Attorney Deborah Katz says there are many cases like Mansfield's. Katz represents a group of federal whistleblowers in a lawsuit against the Office of Special Counsel.
block him into office, and instead of aggressively investigating these complaints, he started doing what he called getting rid of the backlog. And what that meant was really just dismissing complaints rather than investigating them.
As for Bonetta Mansfield, she eventually took her case to another panel. They worked out a settlement. Now she works for a union representing bus drivers and mechanics in North America. Her former boss, Ed Fitzmaurice, remains in government at an agency called the Federal Mediation Conciliation Service. And Scott Block still heads the Office of Special Counsel, where work continues as before. As of today, computer users can no longer buy the operating system Windows XP. And that means consumers will have to buy the newer Vista operating system. We called Lance Ulanoff, the editor-in-chief of PC Magazine, to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Why is Microsoft doing this?
They actually have a new product out there, Vista, and they're really trying to drive people to buying that new operating system, whether they like it or not.
Why wouldn't people want the newer system?
Well, it's very interesting. There were many great promises about the Vista operating system, and I think that Microsoft may have under-delivered a little bit. It is not as easy to use as it should be. It basically is a little bit dissatisfying, and everybody was finally quite satisfied with Windows XP.
But forcing people to buy the new system, whether they like it or not, does not seem like the best way to please your customer base.
It's interesting because they're not entirely moving on. First of all, they're going to sell out whatever XP is still on shelves. They're not really going to pull it. They're just going to say, we're not going to ship it to you anymore so you can sell it. Sell what you have. Also, system manufacturers, they're still going to be selling XP systems until the end of this year and maybe even a little bit after that.
Any other options for people who are just frustrated with Vista and don't want it?
There's always eBay and friends with old copies, but those options are going to become more and more limited. And obviously, well, Microsoft has promised extended support. You know, their attention will start to turn away from this operating system, and so will manufacturers, which means that when you buy new stuff, you may no longer find XP drivers.
Well, what are people's complaints generally about Vista?
They find it confusing. They find that their hardware doesn't work with it. It is a learning curve. They understood how Windows XP worked. Windows XP wasn't, there was kind of this thread of connection, and Vista's a big change. And for example, it does annoying things. There was a very big push on security, except that every time you do something, something pops up to ask you, do you really want to do that? Yeah, it's like, yes, I press the button. Of course I want to do that. But, you know, to Microsoft's credit, Vista is actually a pretty good operating system. It is more secure. It does have a lot of features. And having said that, that's one of the problems. It has a lot of features. Mm-hmm. It's overwhelming to most people.
Does the fact that some customers are dissatisfied with Vista mean they're going to migrate to Macs?
This is prime time for Apple, and they are taking it to Microsoft. You've seen the ads. They know there is an opening here, and a lot of home users are making that choice. Businesses, on the other hand, they're still going with Windows, and they're having the hardest time because, you know, they want to stick with what the whole company is standardized on, which is going to be XP. They don't want to upgrade, and they'll work not to for as long as they can.
So you think while businesses may be stuck with Microsoft, whether they like it or not, individuals for their home computers may make the switch?
Oh, I think so. I think more and more they are because they understand the Macintosh operating system. That platform is a really easy to use, safe operating system. There isn't tremendous confusion. It isn't bloated. And most of those things are true. But as the Apple platform becomes more popular, Macintoshes may be under threat of attack, meaning that, you know, more people will write malware to attack them.
Malware meaning like viruses.
Spyware, exactly.
Lance Ulanoff is editor-in-chief of PC Magazine. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure.